Yael, good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Absolutely. So before we got going, I have to put you on stage for a moment and ask about the last time you picked up that guitar and what you played.
Oh, the last time I picked it up, so I play basically some French-Canadian songs, Elvis songs, and then probably the show that my daughters are watching, whatever the theme song is. I'll try to find the tab or the chords and play it for them. So it's probably one of these, and it'd probably be fairly embarrassing to admit here.
So there'll be no live streams, or rather live performances today.
Not here. I mean, if we want to do something later, you know, that's why I love podcasting 2.0. There's all kinds of musical shows now streaming. Yeah, might be an idea.
Absolutely. And I'm a drummer. I don't have a kit in the back, but there does seem to be a fantastic overlap between those broadly in tech, and we'll talk about your background a bit, and musicians. Well, speaking of background, and certainly I'll include relevant links in the show notes. I mean, what I found interesting, I believe you're Canadian?
French-Canadian, yes.
French-Canadian, most specifically. I know you got your career started in Montreal.
Indeed, yes.
Fantastic. I lived in Toronto for 10 years and had a lot of really great times.
Totally different country, if you ask me, but yes.
Yes. I know. And it feels that way in a great way. But you've got what to me is a quite interesting perspective for a number of reasons, one of which is a Canadian citizen living in Europe. And with Consumer Choice Center, certainly, I know you are, you take a global lens, but in the work that I followed with or from you in the last, say, 6 or so months since we've been connecting on Noster has been understandably U.S. focused. And so, you know, with that, given that interesting background, and actually I'll refer to a couple of quotes that I plucked that I thought were quite interesting. In 2022, let's just dive straight into a hotbed, quote, "If the pandemic taught us anything about public perceptions of risk, it is that we must empower individuals to improve their own situation rather than making it for them." I thought that was quite powerful. And then in December of the same year, you know, you're arguing in a different category of risk, post-FTX collapse. The statement was, "The answer to preventing the next FTX lies less in creating convoluted regulatory environments and more in applying existing laws while promoting a pathway for legitimate entrepreneurship." So I call those out and I set that stage to say you have, as I noted, a broad perspective on consumer choice and what that means. Could you give us sort of a state of the union on the balance of power and the position or place of trust on a continuum between institutions and individuals? What is?
I think it's very interesting in that we have organized our societies, obviously, to live under different types and systems of governments. And I have, as you mentioned, have had the privilege or unfortunate circumstance of having grown up under many different governments. I was born in Canada, grew up in the U.S., and have been living in Austria for the past decade or so. So I've been able to see how different institutions in these countries trust their citizens, enshrine the rights of their citizens, and just generally the approach and the freedom that they allow the citizens. And what I've kind of noticed, and it's just a general trend, is that we have probably for the last 2 decades or so seen that our institutions are much more involved in our lives, much more so than they ever were for our parents or grandparents or even before. And there's this moralization that has come up. And everyone has morals. Everyone has personal morals. Everyone has personal ethics. But a lot of that has sort of been extrapolated and given to governments who, unlike private companies, actually have power over us in that we have to pay taxes. They kind of set the rules for how we're able to invest or where we have to send our kids to school. And we've kind of seen this sort of a morph into each of our lives. And it depends on the government. I think the pandemic, that example that you mentioned, was really an example for everyone to notice. How is my state or my county or my country dealing with this? And are they allowing me as an individual, as a citizen, or as a consumer, enough trust to deal with the situation? And that's where, you know, in my native province of Quebec, it was a terrible idea if you wanted to be an individual and go outside and try to enjoy a little bit of life, even on your own. They made it very difficult There were all kinds of different penalties. There was a curfew. A lot of times I was in North Carolina or in Florida, and there was very different. And it was much more open. Austria, much worse. The masks were obligated basically from March of 2020, very early on. You needed to have your vaccination pass in order to go to the equivalent of like the Best Buy, the electronics store. So there just was not a lot of trust. It was just a lot of power that was given to government. And I think over time, we've just kind of allowed this to happen. And there are communities and people that will go against it. I think I'm always very fascinated by communities like the Amish or the Orthodox Jewish, the Hasidic community that's either in New York or Montreal. These are communities that are self-sustaining. They kind of exist outside or parallel to the normal government structures, and they still thrive, and they exist as communities, and it's voluntary. And I think that's where really that's how we've so many different groups around the world have been able to flourish. And one thing that I'm very passionate about, and I hope we can continue to build on that, we can reverse the trend of sort of growing government power over our decisions. Because I think we as individuals know best exactly what's perfect for us, for our families, and for those in our community. So obviously, a bit of a convoluted way around it. But yeah, I think it comes down to trusting the individual.
Absolutely. And I think, were you at times during lockdowns, were you in Quebec?
No, I was only in Austria. So I was, because I'm also an American citizen and Canadian citizen, I was able to travel. Canada was very bad just because they had this entire system where you have to stay in a hotel for, I don't know, up to two or
Absolutely.
3 weeks.
I recall.
It was very bad. I missed, two funerals for my grandparents because of that reason. And, that was the kind of thing that really made you aware that this is the stuff that restricts your movements. You know, there's a great Austrian writer that many people might know, Stefan Zweig. His works were The Grand Budapest Hotel is what the Wes Anderson movie is.
Brilliant.
It was based
Love
on
that
his
film.
Writings. And he wrote about in the First World War, that was really the first time that we had passports and we had the ability to stop people from going over borders and traveling. And it was really there that he became very depressed with how society was going, how liberalism was going, because all of these countries were erecting barriers. It was in wartime. But those barriers never came down. And it led to what was before this flourishing human experience. If you had the means, you could travel. But really, since then, we've put a lock on that. And then during the pandemic, those walls became iron gates, very high, stopping people from traveling fully. And now we're in 2025. Things are a bit different. But I think many of us still have that in our collective memory because it was only a few years ago.
Absolutely. And I was in Morocco. My wife is Moroccan. And we, without going into too much detail, we were effectively stuck there for about a year. And as an American citizen, for example, couldn't even pop over to Spain. I spent 10 wonderful years living in Toronto. I have very dear friends there that it just became impossible practically to visit. And so we all have those stories. And I think, from that, whether it is your work or broadly at the Consumer Choice Center, has that affected the focus of the organization and your work as deputy director? Like, what did that inject into the mission or were you already on that path?
Yeah, I mean, our organization, when we founded it, we were just a couple of, I would say, liberty-minded individuals who were upset at the status quo and wanted to defend the rights of consumers who want cool stuff, who like technology, who like to travel, who like cheap things, who like to experiment, and yes, take some risk, as it were.
Yeah.
And I think it didn't necessarily change our mission, but it definitely made it much more important. And I thought it was a perfect opportunity to also argue for liberalization. And we did see that. There are a lot of U.S. states that you have state-controlled liquor boards, you have all this kind of thing. And many of those different rules were relaxed throughout the pandemic because they realized, oh my, this is actually not helping our citizenry. It's actually much more expensive and makes things much more difficult. So we did see a lot of relaxation there. We saw a little bit of relaxation when it came to investing and money, and people were throwing their stimulus checks into things like Bitcoin and different meme coins and all the rest. So some things were kind of liberalized. And that's what we were kind of working on behind the scenes as much as possible, is creating frameworks, model policies, putting together press statements, meeting with politicians, giving examples of how, look, right now there's this pandemic, things are going on, we're not going to be able to control all of this, but you do have at your control as a policymaker, let's say, the ability to make X and Y product cheaper or more accessible, and that will improve the lives of consumers. So we did that a little bit. There's all kinds of categories of certain things. Some things obviously got worse, but I think overall we're much better for it. And once again, with that collective memory in mind, I hope we'll remain vigilant if this ever happens again.
Great, great point. And I, among other things, noted on the Consumer Choice Center's website that one of the areas of focus was fun police. And I take your point that, there's been a lot of fun policing. And I found it interesting, and this is, I think, a segue into the next point that I'd like to discuss with you. I appreciate the fact that, if I understand correctly, you and the organization are advocating for, say, things like vaping. I won't make the statement that bluntly or simply, and I'll ask you to add some nuance, but the point being, risk. I'm not a smoker, as with most, I've seen that wreak havoc on my family, and so we all have our position on that. But ultimately, I stand with the position that it's the individual's choice. And so, talk to me a little bit about where that sweet spot is.
Yeah, I think you bring up the example of vaping, and I think that's one that's very important. We're talking about vaping nicotine, not necessarily THC. But this is an industry and a device, and we sort of see it now as this huge conglomerate industry. But this was started by a couple of hackers. There was originally a Chinese pharmacist who had created this kind of prototype, and then you had a lot of more tech-focused guys who figured out how to have aerosols kind of being pushing through nicotine with flavor. This was created as an experiment. It's something that came up out of the market to give people an alternative to smoking cigarettes, to actually having to burn tobacco leaves on fire, inhale it, and feel the nicotine that they're addicted to. And the market and these tinkerers and these entrepreneurs created an alternative. And it actually has, as we know from all the studies now, improved people's lives, and it's removed that element of harm that existed. So most of our activism related to that is just let people access this. There are entire countries where vaping is banned. And I can tell you about the influence of Michael Bloomberg and all of his different philanthropies kind of doing that and how harmful that's been. But in many jurisdictions, the US, Canada, many parts of Europe, we're more open to these technologies and people are using them. There's consumer uptake and people are balancing that risk. You have a place like Sweden where, you had tobacco use, which was very high many, many decades ago. They tend to use more snus and some of these other products. They found ways to use nicotine, which people like or people are addicted to, and they were able to consume it in a less harmful way. And that's something the market delivered, right? It was not a public health institution, organization, and Anthony Fauci type character centrally planning this in some government bureau. It was the market that delivered it, and now consumers are choosing that. So I think, look, as an individual, you have the absolute right to go out and buy a pack of cigars or cigarettes, just as you can buy a lottery ticket, just as you can buy, a liter of whiskey. And you have to practice, if I can go back to Plato and Aristotle, practice your own version of sort of moderation and figuring out the balance and understanding risk. And we can have as many educational programs in schools about it, but we have to trust people at the end of the day. Because if we don't allow adults to make their own decisions, then essentially it's just some centrally controlled machine or computer nowadays that will decide for us. And we lose our free will. We lose our autonomy, and we basically lose the ability to live flourishing lives. And I think that's one thing that at least the vaping debate or nicotine pouch debate, it kind of personifies to me. This is just one small area, and many people won't care about this. Most people, who've never smoked or never touched any tobacco in their lives, it's not a big deal. But for people who are addicted and are packing, 2-3 packs of cigarettes per week or whatever it might be, this is life-changing. And to show that there is an alternative path, that some kind of free enterprise system has delivered this, it's something to celebrate. And far too often we see too many people who denigrate technology and all the great things that it brings for us. Believe me, I'm skeptical of many technologies as well. Sometimes they do go too far. But here we've actually seen dividends for people's health and people's choices. And I think that's great.
That is great. And I raised that, and not surprisingly, you've illustrated that wonderfully, that it is, for many, perhaps an edge case. You know, well, why would we? Why would we provide that opportunity, that choice? It's harmful, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it does characterize or personify that individual choice. And I think that takes me to the question of, you know, your work is all about handing the reins to the individuals, as we've just discussed. On balance, who do today's consumers trust and why?
I think peers, you know, peers, their own peers, people in their networks, people they know. We're much more likely to try something new. If it's in our social circle, we're much more inclined to get interested into something like Bitcoin. If somebody we know and we trust talks about it or has Bitcoin on them, or perhaps it's some new technology, new type of computer. I mean, we see it as well sociologically with people who have iPhones versus Androids, right? It'll depend on your social network, it'll depend on who you're in contact with. So I think there's a lot there. I think for the younger generation, there's a lot of trust that's placed into what we unfortunately would dub influencers and people online. And we can have all types of different people who are discussing topics or technologies, and we can learn from their experiences. I mean, I definitely have, particularly in, let's say, the Bitcoin or the privacy space, I've learned a lot from people who do content and do reviews and show how technologies work and how one thing might be an advantage. And I think that sort of peer system is really what gives me, as an individual, most of my recommendations and what I follow. And I think that's one great, beautiful thing about the internet, is that it is global and you can be connected with these people. They don't have to be right there in your neighborhood. It could be just a certain corner of the internet. And that, I think, has provided so much wealth and so much value for everyone and really has improved our lives. So it's we have to keep protecting the free and open internet always.
Always, always. Well, you know, I did not hear you name institutions or brands. Is that out the window in terms of consumer trust? And I presume the older the age bracket, the more perhaps it shifts. What's your take on where institutions or brands fall in that spectrum?
Well, we definitely see it with social media, right? We're much more drawn to individuals than institutions. We're much more likely to read the words of someone who, let's say, is a top opinion writer at the Wall Street Journal, let's say, right? Whatever outlet you prefer. We're much more attuned to what they say as an individual, knowing that they have likes and dislikes and they have a bias and they're human characters, much more so than just what the Wall Street Journal says, for instance. And it's the same with many different companies. You know, we just are, as human beings, we're just much more likely to follow people, knowing all of their flaws, knowing that they also have to deal with the same logic and the balance of risk. You know, I think we're just much more, as human beings, apt to follow that. And yeah, it is not institutions. And that was something that we've learned through the pandemic, and we learned through all types of different financial crises, is, do you trust institutions only? Do you trust people? Do you trust, you know, those who are in your peer network? I think we can learn a lot from particularly how we're put in those situations and who to follow. And so I think there's still room, obviously, to trust institutions, but they have to have values. They have to have people who are smart and intelligent and that we can identify with as human beings to ultimately gain that trust. It's very hard to trust a faceless organization. Always better to have good, smart people there working there too.
You took the words right out of my mouth. And I think in that vein, let's talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, which, you know, you have spoken out with regard to, and certainly it is, correct me, in the process of being largely or wholly dismantled in the current U.S. administration. What does the public or otherwise visible tug of war between rules and innovation, and you've called out technology specifically, what does that do to the public's faith in the sort of scaffolding that typically we have all leaned on, watching that play out? What does that do to a consumer's perspective?
I didn't know you were going there, but that's a great question. I think overall, what a lot of government institutions do is they attach a name to it. And, you know, this goes back to Friedrich Bastiat. You know, just because the state says it does a certain thing and that it's its intention, it doesn't mean that that's the result. So it's called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the idea is that we protect consumers. And I think most people take that at face value. Certainly, I would say with the social media hate that I got after writing and speaking about CFPB and why we're probably right to defang it, I think people just see that as an institution and take it for granted. It's like, okay, yeah, they're there to protect consumers.
It does what it says on the tin.
But as always, you have to look at how is this set up? How does it get its funding? What kind of cases does it do? What's the process? Let's say I were screwed as a consumer and something happened. You know, what's the process? What do I have to do? And then it's just also going back to Bastiat, it's the seen and the unseen. What we see is these kind of record. We say we have $30 billion, you know, we've returned to consumers, you know, who've been scammed or screwed in some way. Well, that's the seen. But the unseen is that most of these instances, you know, did not really level up to that amount. We see that generally with the general litigiousness of the U.S. lawsuit system. You know, there's all types of lawsuits that are filed against Apple or Microsoft or Google or Marriott hotels every single day. Many of them don't have merit, and it's somebody who, you know, whatever, slipped by the pool because they were running or, you know, they messed up their device in some way. And in the, at least U.S. society, we've just kind of allowed, all right, we'll let these things happen. We'll settle a few and that'll just get rid of the annoyance. We don't want to go to court. We don't want to battle. And that's what CFPB was kind of doing, is that it would look at certain players in the financial markets, those who offer financial products to consumers, and it would just launch a lawsuit and then hope they would settle. And you didn't really have too many actual settled lawsuits that were, you had a ruling by a judge. Most of it was just settlements. So that's how they got a bunch of money, built up a war chest. And many of the new innovators, guys who are working with fintech, people who are working with cryptocurrencies, who would like to offer some type of banking system or some ability to use different layers like Lightning or Liquid, if they wanted to bring their product to market, they knew they would be right in the crosshairs of an agency like CFPB. So you have documented instances of innovators holding back their products or their vision because they're scared of how the government will intervene and regulate them. And I think that's what CFPB represents. There are already mechanisms in society to crack down on fraud, on abuse, on, you know, deception when it comes to consumers. We already have agencies. We already have laws. This was a particular agency created just a decade ago that became this bona fide a sort of hero of post-financial crisis, but really was just an extraction machine. And, you know, it's hard in the world of public policy sometimes to explain that because you're dealing with an organization that has a good reputation, at least online. They bring money. But we have to look at the institutional, the structural things, and like Bastiat, the seen and the unseen, which unfortunately in public policy, most people are very happy and you just casually put that away.
And I'm guessing this goes to the core, to the heart of the work that you and the team do. How important is it to raise consciousness, awareness of, in this case, CFPB and its arguable pointlessness, if not harm? Is it worthwhile work to direct consumers, to direct individuals to those organizations, those institutions, perhaps that are on mission and do deserve trust, or maybe cynically, is it a lost cause because everyone's tuned out?
Well, I think it is worth it only because not everybody is motivated to do that type of work, and not everybody is willing to question the status quo. And I think that's what most people need more of, is they need a healthy skepticism of centralized power. Notice I said centralized power. I did not say just government power or private power. We just need to have skepticism of people who have power and those institutions and how they're created. And I think that's kind of what has always motivated me and definitely motivates my colleagues. And we just need to have that awareness. I think that's why I started out my career as a journalist. I was very passionate about it. You know, it's one of the only jobs that exist in the Constitution, freedom of the press, First Amendment. And the ability to have a check on centralized power is, I think, one of the best things that we've been able to, at least in Western liberal democracies, been able to protect, because it means that we have an alternative narrative from that gist of power. And if you have organizations such as mine or many others that do great work, I think we need to have that. We need to be able to keep people in check. You know, the pricing mechanism is one way that you keep things in check on the private market. How do you judge institutions? How do you judge governments? You know, that's why you need logical arguments. You need to have political debates. You need to have analysis about what they're affecting, how much they cost. I think you do need to have that. And I think a lot of the work that I do, again, I view it as an extension of just journalism and uncovering the truth and being sure to practice that freedom of the press that, at least in the U.S. Constitution for now, is protected and recognized.
There's a lot there. There's 100 questions I could ask you, but let's shift a bit to Bitcoin Policy Institute. You are a visiting fellow and have been, I believe, since 23,
but I'm now a fellow. I'm no longer visiting.
Oh, brilliant. Excellent. Well, I have the great pleasure of counting Stephen Pollack as a dear friend. Big fan of his, big fan of the organization. Have been delighted to support them. You know, we've talked so far quite a bit about how policy lags or stumbles behind tech, especially with things like Bitcoin. At least half of the political apparatus in the U.S. had been hoping to kill it. And we've mentioned CFPB. How does that lag between policy and technology innovation sort of shape the street cred of the relevant institutions?
That is I think a pinnacle question. And just on Nostr the other day, I published an article, something about meme coins and, you know, Bitcoin policies. And I had some anons who were not too happy. You know, they're like, policies? What are you talking about? Policies with cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin? What are you talking about? You
don't protocol. What's policy
protocol? What are you talking about? And I think this is where, you know, most people who are not in the political process, you know, kind of just view Bitcoin policies like, okay, this is what we want government to do. That's not it. It's the complete opposite. What people are trying to do who are advocates of a technology like Bitcoin, let's say, our goal is to limit the actions of what the government can do. And that is so different. What we're talking about is not rules to govern individuals' behavior. It's rules to govern the behavior of governmental institutions, which restrict our liberties. And that is, for so many people, difficult to understand. It's this kind of positive law aspect that grew from the progressive era, from FDR, this kind of notion that we need to regulate society, provide the rules, and then people act, rather than the point of the rules is to govern the institutions, and then the people are free to make their own decisions. So for especially Bitcoin policy, Bitcoin can exist and will exist and will be very strong without any government rule. The problem now is not that there are not enough government rules, it's that the rules that are on the books are themselves restrictive of the technology. I'll give you an example. It's just for taxation purposes. If we finish this up and, you know, I want to pay you for a video project and I want to send you, you know, $2,000 worth of Bitcoin, and you receive that, you technically have just received money that is a taxable transaction, and you'll have to put that in your IRS kind of tax statement at the end of the year. That is something that's governed by U.S. tax law. Now, how do we change that? What do we do? What's the particular section that we can do? How can we increase the amount so that the threshold is much higher so that these kind of transactions are not taxable events, and we can use Bitcoin as intended, as just sound money between people, as money? And I think that's what a lot of the focus of Bitcoin policy is. Do we need positive laws? You can probably think of some, but most of the time, we just need the government to be restrained and allow individuals and firms to come up with solutions. I mentioned the de minimis thing. There's also the ability for banks to hold Bitcoin, the ability for liquidity service providers, you know, to be able to not have to KYC their users. That is something that restrains them right now and also means that many of the great Lightning products that might exist in Europe don't exist in the United States. So it's these kind of things to where the goal is not to try to craft policy and figure out ways, you know, the individuals can be better governed to make better decisions about Bitcoin. It's just restraining the government and allowing the protocol to exist and thrive and nobody be penalized for using it, including developers of technologies like Samurai Wallet or things on other chains like Tornado Cash. These are just kind of the examples.
And some key examples.
And this is seen at the state level, by the way, a lot. This is something that the left and the right politically have been very good at. It's called preemption laws. So examples on the right include no locality is allowed to ban plastic bags, for instance. So this is something that has been put in place in many Republican states. And then you have on the other side, let's say the left, it's, okay, no locality is able to ban cannabis sales if we've legalized cannabis. So these are preemption laws instituted at the state level that, you know, again, are not governing individual behavior. They're governing the behavior of jurisdictions and institutions beneath them. And I think that is just a beautiful part of the American experiment and the way that the Constitution is written, in how law is structured, and we've adhered much more to natural law and to restricting institutions, particularly in sort of US, Canada, some parts of Europe, than many other countries. And I think that is something that we don't talk about enough, is that the American Constitution specifically protects so much of Bitcoin already. You know, there's no new law needed. We just take it and apply it to the 21st century model. And we know that this code is speech and it is protected.
I think the idea, it is interesting as I was listening to you to think about how foreign, alien, the idea of restraint with regard to the government has become, at least in I feel like my circles in the US. And I think it's a really important point to clarify, is that much of this work, if not all of this work, is focused on restraint. How much does the lack of restraint historically, and perhaps that changes, how much has that lack of restraint and that overt involvement, if not interference, slowed the adoption of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think it's definitely been restricted. And, you know, I was an early local bitcoins.com user. I was living in Florida at the time, in St. Petersburg, beautiful city. I was there much too soon in my life, but wonderful place. When I was living there, that's when I got very interested into Bitcoin. You know, it was like late 2012, early 2013. And they had this website, Local Bitcoins. And, you know, at the time, I think the only website that existed was Coinbase. But if you wanted to, you could log on to Local Bitcoins. You could find somebody at a cafe and they'd be willing to exchange cash, Bitcoin, you know, either way. And I used sites like that, you know, also in Europe. And I thought it was great. And you talk about, you know, which laws have restricted Bitcoin. I think if we just go to the root of it all, it is the Bank Secrecy Act. And this law that was passed in the 1970s, why is this important? It has to do with banks. Well, yes, but it also makes it much more difficult for you to create a type of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency exchange so that people can acquire it. Because that's the number one question someone who's never touched Bitcoin has is, okay, how do I get this? What's the process? All right, well, you go to this website and you have to provide your ID, you need to provide your address, both have to match, you have to take a picture. That's all required by the Bank Secrecy Act. Again, been around since the 1970s. And each of these exchanges have limits on the amount that you're able to buy or transfer without sufficient documentation. And the limits on banks, everyone knows this number is $10,000. So you send over $10,000, it triggers a suspicious activity report. Well, most people don't know that for cryptocurrency exchanges, things like Coinbase, Binance, Strike, Cash App, if you send over $2,500, that also triggers a suspicious activity report because they are actually targeted as money transmission services. So those are parts of the law that have been applied to Bitcoin sort of after the fact. And they kind of kept updating the law to say, okay, well, now for any digital assets service, in order to exchange fiat, you know, we need to put these restrictions on there. And that is where you've had a lot of people who haven't been able to get Bitcoin. And a lot of times it was, you know, I'm a college student. The address that's on my license is not where I live. I don't have like a lease. I'm just not able to prove my identity. And I think those are things that have really, that did keep the Bitcoin network from growing, at least in terms of user adoption, because people couldn't get it. And I'll be frank, not everybody is willing to go to a cafe and meet someone and exchange, you know, cash for Bitcoin or whatever it might be. A lot of people are just not that intellectually curious to dive into something. We want things to be easy, and we want things to be, in the good model of consumer choice, simple and easy, and we reduce as many barriers as possible. And I think once Bitcoin exchanges, crypto exchanges, and now liquidity service providers, custodians generally, once the Bank Secrecy Act stuff was applied to this, it made it much more difficult. So it's like the law caught up to the technology, but did so in a worse way. So I think that is one clear example, at least for me.
Absolutely. I mean, a personal, professional anecdote. I began working in Bitcoin in 2020. Was running business development for Bottle Pay. You may know, out of the UK. We were acquired by NYDIG. Found myself leading business development for the Lightning Payments sort of group or function within the company. And the vast majority of my time was spent with banks, as was our larger teams. And since the choke point 2.0 unredacted or semi-redacted documents, you know, flowed into the public, you will see NYDIG. And I don't speak for them any longer, but you will see names of the banks that we were working with, that we had fantastic, you know, beta programs and trials with. And ultimately, the whole thing came falling down because they just weren't given the explicit permission, despite the fact that every bit of research indicated, and those who don't want banks to have anything to do with the with Bitcoin at all, you know, close your ears. But the reality is most consumers, and you can correct or back this up, I think, would prefer to acquire it, to buy, sell, hold from their existing financial institutions. And so that is all to say that I saw firsthand, you know, the tremendous slowdown or impact that had on consumer adoption, at least in the U.S. So with that, let's talk about stablecoins. Let's dig a little more into the controversial material. I mean, you have covered Senator Lummis and others' proposed legislation about this. There appears to be, with the current administration, a big push into stablecoins. To what degree is that necessary on the path, perhaps, to broader hard money adoption, specifically Bitcoin, or to what degree does it just reclaim control to the usual parties?
I there is definitely an element of control. And, you know, the specific bill you're talking about is called the Genius Act. So it is passed committee. We'll go to the Senate floor probably any day now, maybe once this goes out. And what I found troublesome about this bill, again, this is independent of any thoughts of stablecoins generally, essentially, it requires that all those KYC provisions that we mentioned before are applied to every stablecoin transaction. Okay, that's a no-go. And then second, the Federal Reserve just has the power to basically veto any attempt at launching or issuing a stablecoin, which, again, what's the whole point of the Federal Reserve? I thought that it was this independent entity that had nothing to do with kind of the larger thing. Those of us who were very much into Ron Paul, you know, in 2008 and 2009, we know differently. But I think what the argument that we're kind of seeing, there are many people who are passionate about this as purely an American dominance strategy. You know, Tether, which is one of the large stablecoin sort of providers or protocols, they're one of the largest purchasers of U.S. treasuries. Those treasuries are bonds. It's U.S. debt. They buy a lot of debt, a lot of U.S. debt. All that debt that we talk about, $36 trillion that Doge is trying to kind of nibble at, you know, a lot of that is owned by some of these stablecoin companies, things like Tether.
Tether is the number two holder. Is that right? If I understand.
Well, amongst sovereigns, if we include governments and stuff, it's like number 11. But probably in terms of an institution, likely, yeah. But in terms of countries, I think Tether is like just behind Luxembourg, which is really interesting. But I think they are. What will be the relevancy for Bitcoin and for sovereign money and for, you know, separation of money and state? I'm not quite sure, right? I think it's a lot about just technological evolution of money. One path that the European Union is following is, and I'll probably bring you reports in a couple of months, is there is a central bank digital currency, the digital euro, which is launching in the fall. Now, private banks don't want this, right? Because they're cut out of the equation.
Cut out, right.
there's individual citizens, I think, don't want it either because they don't want to be tracked and traced and everything else. And these are all other debates that you can have. But I think it's at least interesting to see how we allow our existing very heavily regulated institutions like banks to deal with the new digital age of cryptocurrencies. If stablecoins are just the kind of onboarding, and then they can also deal with Bitcoin, and they can also be an important node in the network, fine. You know, they can run a node just like I can. And, you know, our nodes are equal. Theirs are not, you know, right, any more powerful than mine. You know, we're just there verifying the blocks, and that's
it. One vote per node.
Exactly. So, yeah, I don't take any larger lessons from it. Obviously, my colleague Matthew Pines has done great writing on this and you know, has provided very good advice to the Trump administration. I'm not a user necessarily of stablecoins. I think for most people in the developed world, we don't really need stablecoins. I think it is something for the developing world where they do have terribly inflationary currencies that are very bad and make their lives worse. But yeah, I'll be interested to see how this kind of evolves. But I do think it's just the launching pad for a lot of the traditional financial institutions to eventually get to Bitcoin. They will realize as much as we do, I think, its value.
Well, closer to your backyard in the EU, do you think there's an awareness of the tremendous risks, I would say, of central bank digital currencies, A? And does that bleed over into consumers' views, trust, or lack thereof, of Bitcoin specifically, and perhaps stable coins more broadly?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at the heart of Europe, you know, the largest, most populous country, obviously, is Germany. And Germany, and where I am in Austria, these are technically societies that are very skeptical of digitized money. You know, if you look at just the charts of people who invest, you know, Austria is one of the lowest investing countries in the world because people mostly buy gold. They buy gold and they use cash. So we have many different areas, you know, where I live. If I go around, I have to have cash because they don't accept the bank cards. They don't want to touch it. So there has always been this skepticism, and that's from, you know, Weimar Republic, hyperinflation, world wars. There's this kind of innate skepticism that exists when it comes to money. You know, if it's not something I can touch, not something hard, that is not something that I trust. So I think there's generally going to be skepticism of a digital euro. The problem in the European Union is you just don't have the mechanism necessarily to oppose it. I know it sounds weird, but many scholars who study EU stuff know there's a term called democratic deficit. It's not an actual full democracy. It's not necessarily a republic. There's a commission which is elected based on the votes of who's in parliament. It's a very strange kind of supranational government that's a bit removed from what people vote on. So even if we are very much against the digital euro, and I probably register there are tens of millions, they're still going to try to push it. For individuals, then it's just incumbent upon them to use the different technologies. And I've been asked about this before. You know, there's a good friend of mine, Nikolaus Jilch, who's a great Bitcoin podcaster, who's here in Austria.
Nico.
And he's dealt with that too. Yeah, Nico, he's great.
Yeah,
and he's
Absolutely.
Been able to kind of demystify that because he knows these financial types, he knows these regulators, he knows the guys at the big banks, and he knows that the general public is skeptical of just digital money numbers on a screen anyway. And I think that's why learning about how nodes work, learning about how your public key and your private key works and seed phrases, you know, to understand that there's a bit more complexity just under that layer, I think that's just the next level of education. I think that's why educators are important. It's why podcasters are important. It's why, you know, talking about this stuff and informing not just policymakers, but users is really important.
And with that, what does good governance look like? If let's assume, in the most charitable interpretation, a regulatory body, a government, wishes to earn back the trust and earn back the right to regulate, to govern, what are the tenets that you propose, that you espouse, that you would advise are key?
I think the most important thing is that just if citizens don't have to think about it, right? There's no scandal. There's no ways it's making our lives worse or more expensive. It just kind of does its function and delivers or somehow changes public goods, and that's it. And there are no larger debates. I think this is a major problem that happens once you socialize public health systems, for instance, is that normal, ordinary things that would happen between doctors and patients, you know, are elevated to huge levels of the bureaucracy, and it becomes a political thing. It's things to vote on, and what's the government budget, and then my taxes are going, you know, as soon as you increase the kind of grasp of the state into a particular activity, it means that it renders all of that to a kind of democratic debate. And naturally, just because of how things work, once they get bigger, a lot of dysfunction. So I think you want to have effective institutions, but those that we don't have to think about. And I think many Scandinavian countries are actually fairly good at this. They have fairly small governments. They are able to deliver their services, and that's it. You know, great Baltic and Northern European states like Estonia are just wonderful. Very small footprint, technologically savvy. People know what's what. There's no complicated bureaucracy that you have to deal with. Everything is online, and nobody has to debate about that. You can actually just live your life. You can start your business. You can raise your family and make your own decisions. And I think that's ultimately the goal of what we should, as advocates, push for, is the ability to take more of those decisions ourselves and not have it be this huge public thing, big institutions, elections all of the time. Not everything has to be rendered to a huge nationwide vote. And we as consumers make millions of decisions a day. And we should be empowered to do that more, not less. And I think that's why the healthcare example, I think, is so important, and one I know that you're passionate about too.
Very poignant. And I, you know, I'm an American, and in that I enjoy, as you are, a tremendous amount of benefit. But I hear you say things like not having to think about it and not having to worry about what some government agency may enjoy. It's fantastical to me. I found myself just struggling, like drifting off into what would that be like? But it is so common sense and yet challenging. Hopefully we're headed more in that direction. So from government orgs, agencies, regulators to private markets to businesses, if you were advising someone, let's say in consumer products, perhaps they're heading up a product line, a brand, if they're a CXO, what have you, how do they re-earn trust? What are some of the tenets, behaviors that you see? And maybe you have examples of companies doing this well. What does good look like in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, if I knew fully, you know, I'd be a millionaire and having all my own companies.
Yes, but you and generally, I would not be here. You'd be out building those products.
Yeah, no, I'd be on a boat somewhere. I think generally it just comes down to, you know, let people test and use it. I think that's why I keep coming back to Bitcoin, but you're able to run it yourself, test it, and increasingly with many of these LLMs and AI, you know, for most people, it's just going to be a click on chatgpt.com. But for those who are just a little technically savvy, you can actually run this on your own computer. You know, if you have a NAS or if you have something else, you can actually see how this works. And I think that gives people a lot of trust. It allows them to tinker, allows them to change things. So yeah, just generally the advice is just to, you know, allow people to be part of that story and to put some skin in the game. You know, I think it's obviously it's great. People love things like Apple products or let's say Tesla cars or whatever it might be. And they like it because it improves their life and they're able to customize things how they want. And I couldn't tell you a grand strategy as to reach out to all the consumers because I'm still looking to do that myself with my public policy research.
Absolutely.
But surely allowing people to have some skin in the game to, you know, modify, customize. I mean, that's one great thing about the internet is that everything can be so tailored and targeted. And we really like that. You know,
would you include right to repair in that? I mean, to what degree, when you mentioned Apple and Tesla, brilliant products, but largely sealed black boxes, how much does the ability to open that box, open that lid, and see inside and tinker, does that matter these days? Does anyone care?
I'm asked about right to repair more than anything. It's interesting, sort of as you know, I grew up, my dad was a NASCAR mechanic, so obviously I'm big into cars and secondary parts and You know, if you have something break down, you want to be able to just order a part and it's fine. You don't have to go to the dealership. But, you know, if you're an entrepreneur making a product, you know, are you having to render every part of your process to some open tender system so that anybody can offer the, I mean, you have your vision. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're a business owner, your vision of doing things and you're hoping to sell it. What part of it do you need to cut open so that other people can also offer products? At the same time, as a consumer, yes, I'd love to be able to use third-party things with Apple devices. Or so I think there's not a clear-cut answer. There are many bills in Congress that where this has been debated and people figuring out. And there are egregious examples, John Deere tractors and things like this.
Certainly.
Yeah, I don't know the right answer.
DRM on the tractor was not on my bingo card.
Yeah, especially that. And, you know, intellectual property is something that is actually fairly important. And, you know, if you look at the difference between China and Western Europe and the United States, you know, we have a kind of sacrosanct intellectual property system that protects many profits and benefits for innovators. And that is actually carried down to consumers. How is it so different in China? What are they doing? You know, what kind of intellectual property theft is there? Whole complicated thing. I know many of the Randians and Ayn Rand crowd might agree or disagree with that.
There's, yes, indeed.
Different ways to think about it.
You read my mind on that one. I mean, you know, I think about Disney and what I would argue. I have a background as well in media, entertainment, music, and the ability to lobby to continue to extend those protections.
And that's another example right there, and you bring it up perfectly, is that too much of lobbying is just in getting protections for your business and for carving out part of the market just for you and rent seeking. Yes. And I hope that's what Bitcoin allows us to go around, because it is an open network and an open protocol. And I hopefully we can take more of that attitude with other sectors of the economy and other parts of our society and render everything to competition. But I guess it's just one step at a time.
Indeed. Well, on that, I'd love to close with maybe some examples, your thoughts on what gives you hope. What examples beyond perhaps Bitcoin do you see as heading in the right direction, as promising with regard to engendering trust among consumers and doing the right thing, however you would define that?
Yeah, I think I've been, you know, living and working in different countries and settings and being able to travel. And I think just generally technological progress, the way that is going, is just so beneficial for humanity. And we do get always locked in these kind of struggles of, well, things are so hard or this isn't working. But, you know, the amount that you as an individual are able to travel and see the world as compared to two generations ago, you just can't compare it. And the things that you're able to learn, the things that you're able to access, the value you're able to transfer, and the type of work that you're going to have now and in the future, and the ability to act on your ideas or your entrepreneurial projects or wishes, it's just infinite. And I think that's something that we don't often sit back and realize. You know, it was not more than two generations ago that we would have been stuck in factories, most of us just kind of plugging away our 9-to-5 and not have many other options. But now, because of the internet, because of technology, because of innovations, we're able to live these lives. You know, there are people who roam around the globe living on Bitcoin, being able to transfer value, not having to go through strange KYC processes, able to run their businesses from an Asian beach or some interesting place in Colombia. I think this is something that is not just for certain people who are well-to-do, it's for everyone. And that's what I'm very hopeful about, is that technology is getting better. As long as we remain principled, as long as we hold back some of the institutions that will make our lives worse and try to take control and take decisions away from us, we can remain free as individuals. We can actually benefit from that flourishing and that progress. And it's something that I know I benefit from each and every day. I'm able to learn about things. I'm able to travel. I'm able to meet people. And I think that just makes me much better as a human being, and makes me realize that my daughters and everyone that comes after me, they're going to have great lives too. So it always gives me a lot of motivation.
Well, cheers to that. Absolutely. It's a great, great way and a great place to wrap it up. I will, of course, have your relevant links in the show notes. With regard to your work, BPI, Consumer Choice Center, your individual writing, where is the best place to follow you specifically?
Yeah, I just have it all over there on yael.ca. You can just follow there as my main website. And Bitcoin writing on Nostr, I'm pretty easy to find as well. Yael.
Gotta get the Nostr plug in.
Yeah, please do. It's a very interesting network of people there, some haters, some lovers, and you as well. It's great.
Yeah, we've got it all. Well, it's been a pleasure, Yael. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for taking the time. And I will look forward to following particularly some of these pressing Bitcoin and stablecoin issues that you're tracking and your work in general. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Sean. You do give me a little bit of a trust revolution. So thank you.
Cheers to that. Bye-bye.